Transmission start. Welcome to Where Did the Road Go? Join us as we wander off the path and explore lost history, consciousness, the paranormal, unexplained mysteries, alternative thought, and much more. We are present on the web at wheredidtheroadgo.com. Now here is your host, Soraya.
Greetings and welcome to this edition of Where Did the Road Go? Tonight I'm going to be talking with Seth Breedlove about his new documentary on the Mothman, entitled The Mothman of Point Pleasant. And it's an excellent documentary. It's his fourth now, after the Minervan Monster, Beast of Whitehall, and Boggy Creek Monster. I'm pretty sure it's my favorite, but I've always loved the Mothman story. And he has some really interesting stuff on there. Well worth checking out. You can get it on Vimeo, Amazon, and a bunch of other places. But you can check them out at smalltownmonsters.com for more info. And I arranged for five copies of it, five streaming copies, for patrons. So I'm going to figure out how to give those away later in the week. So if you're a patron, Patreon, whatever you want to call it, you have a chance of getting a free copy of the Mothman documentary. If you want to become a Patreon, it's only $3 a month. You get extra stuff almost every week. And you can do that at wheredidtheroadgo.com, same place you can go to find everything Where Did the Road Go related. So without any further ado, here's my conversation with Seth Breedlove. All right, Seth, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me back on.
And you've released your third documentary.
Fourth. But who's counting?
Clearly not me. Oh, that's right. It is the fourth, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because you have the Minerva Monster, you have the one from upstate New York, the Beast of Whitehall, and then you have the Boggy Creek Monster. I totally forgot the Whitehall one.
You know what? To be honest with you, though, I forget what we're working on when we're making it, because we just finished filming the fifth, and while we were there, I kept referring to it as our sixth, just because it feels like we've made so many in such a short period of time. But yeah, it's easy to lose track, I think.
So this one is about the Mothman, and this is one of my favorite subjects anyway. Keel got me into this, and I just have always, you know, I really liked the way Keel presented things, and this was such a bizarre case with so many different elements to it, and you guys really do it justice in this documentary.
Cool. Thank you. Part of what scared me about doing the Mothman story was that there are so many documentaries and books and stuff about this subject. And I can remember talking to Lauren Coleman about this at one point, and he really advised me against making the movie because he said I would end up spending all my time trying to figure out my own angle to the story instead of just concentrating on the story. And when he said that to me, it kind of snapped me back to reality that, oh, you know what, let's just make the movie and figure out the story as we go. And just, I think Brandon at one point, the guy that does our music and all that, he at one point told me, I think just our style of making the movie will be enough to kind of set it apart. But I do think at the end of the day, we got, you know, I think we have a decent amount of stuff in here that hasn't been overdone in every other documentary. And I think there's a lot of new material we added to it. And also it was just a story I don't think I wanted to pass up having a stake in telling.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it is really one of the strangest, I don't even know what to call it. You could call it a monster type of a situation, but it's not just monsters. I mean, there's UFOs, there's everything. It's like a plethora of Fortiana.
Yeah.
a little bit of
smorgasbord.
Yeah, a little bit of everything mixed in there. Now you had Lyle Blackburn narrate this one again.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I have no problem with that. I think that's great. It seems like a little bit outside of what Lyle normally does.
Right. No, I mean, when it comes to that, I separate the researcher from the material that we're working on. And I just felt like his voice would be suited to this because it's still kind of is the South, and he's got that Southern kind of twang, and it made sense for this particular story. And also I just liked working with Lyle on Boggy.
Mm-hmm.
part of it had to do as well with the fact that I wanted him to edit my narration, and that ended up turning into a co-writing credit, because he had to rewrite so much of what I was writing because I was kind of pressed for time in the edit, and I didn't put probably as much into writing the narration as I could have. So he ended up helping me out on that end. But mostly it was just the fact that we wanted to work together again. Now our next one, the Invasion on Chestnut Ridge, that is being narrated by my buddy Mark Matsky, who I did Saswa. So it's just dependent on the story. We're very conscious of the story needing, you know, a specific narrator or no narrator. I'd like to at some point go back to the no narration thing that we started with Minerva Monster, just to see how we could progress that kind of storytelling, because it's so different. But yeah, Lyle's, I don't think people think of Lyle when they think of the Mothman, because he hasn't touched it in terms of his books, but he's done written stuff in his Rumored column about it, and he speaks pretty frequently at the Mothman Festival. He's been down there 3 times, and he's going to be down there with me this year. So he's connected to it, just not, I don't think a lot of people automatically connect him to that.
Yeah, he's not as visible on it.
Right.
So one of the things I wanted to ask you about as you were going through this, this is a Native American burial ground where the TNT area was, right?
So, yeah, I mean, there's so many stories about the TNT area that you can't quite separate what is fact and what is fiction.
Right.
So this is what we were told while we were there, is that there are burial grounds for Native Americans in the area where the TNT factory area was eventually built. But to be fair, there's Native American bodies kind of scattered all over that area down there. So I definitely sure. think, yeah, I definitely think that isn't out of the question, and it's in the narration as something we mentioned kind of offhandedly. But I mean, when we were down there, a couple months ago filming this TV show, and while we were there, I mentioned the fact that Denny Bellamy, the tourism director, had told us that there were these tunnels that kind of snake their way underneath the McClintock Wildlife Management Area, because they were built back when TNT was there. And not a single person in the group that we were in knew that. And those are all, it was all locals, but they were mostly younger people. So I think there's a lot of history to that area that is forgotten about, or, you know, gets kind of lost to time, but it's definitely a creepy kind of area. And it wouldn't surprise me a bit if it's horribly haunted with natives or, you know, something like that. Cause it definitely is part of the lore of the place.
Now, one of the things you mentioned in conjunction with that, though, is that it's also the Native Americans avoided it because it's where the waters mingled.
Mm-hmm.
And what is that about?
Yeah, again, this is one of those like conflicting things I'm hearing about. So the stories go, and anytime you do research into Point Pleasant, you'll find that the way it's written in the history books is that there were no Native Americans living directly in Point Pleasant, where Point Pleasant is today, because of the fact that the Kanawha River and the Ohio River come together there. And supposedly there's something that says that there's some sort of superstition, or whatever you would call it, part of their belief system, is that you do not actually live or abide in a place where waters mingle. Now I spoke with, a lady who claims that that isn't true. And there were in fact Native Americans living directly in Point Pleasant, but, I don't know how factual that is, because I couldn't find anything about settlements or Native villages or anything being right there where the town is. It's not a very big town, you know? I mean,
yeah,
like the downtown area, especially right by the river, there's no history of a settlement or anything being located right there. Now they were located further south, and that was why the Battle of Point Pleasant was originally fought, was to keep the settlers from settling or from kind of starting to infringe into native territory, because there were a lot of settlements further south of Point Pleasant. But yeah, directly in town, no. Isn't it funny too that, like, with all this amazing history, like, there's so much history connected to that town, and a lot of it is really fascinating. But the town is best known for this, like, winged demon legend that sprung up in 1966. I just think that's so cool, because I'm not aware of another small town in America where they have that kind of epic history, and but they're most connected to their local monster.
Fair enough. I don't think anyone even heard of Point Pleasant before the bridge collapse, really.
Right.
The reason I was wondering about the water mingling thing is because, you know, it falls into that liminality category, and it brings to mind, you know, crossroads and things like that, mm-hmm. where you find the paranormal drawn to these cross points and these liminal points. And clearly that area is very strong in paranormal phenomena.
Right.
Mothman and otherwise.
Yeah, because it's not just Mothman. I mean, that's the thing. Even with the 66 story, obviously there were the UFOs and the Men in Black, but I mean there was poltergeist activity taking place around Linda Scarberry's home, and the Low Hotel is right there, and that's considered one of the most haunted spots in America. And I mean there's a lot of stuff that goes on around that town, but to me, there's a reason we mention the Ohio Valley so frequently in the movie. I grew up in Bolivar, Ohio, which is only like from the Ohio River. I grew up 90 minutes from the Ohio River, and the TV station that my family could get on our rabbit ears on our TV when I was a kid was the Charleston, West Virginia, or Wheeling, West Virginia TV station. And I always grew up with watching Wheeling TV, and there was something about the Ohio Valley, the news in the Ohio Valley when I was a kid always had some sort of story about like ghost sightings or UFOs or strange lights in the sky, satanic cults. Like there was always this weird kind of vibe out of the Ohio Valley to me as a kid. And I wanted to kind of like, at least secretly kind of sandwich that into the movie. I really, one of the vibes, I wanted the movie to have this like very specific mood. And part of it was informed by how creeped out I was by the Ohio Valley idea when I was a kid.
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's definitely a hot spot for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I wonder if that sort of crossroads type of thing, that liminality, has any factor into it.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely possible. It's interesting. I've never read, now I could be wrong about this, I don't think I've ever read Keel mention that fact.
No, I don't think he ever did.
Yeah. And you know, I mean, Mary Heyer's article was called, you know, the column she wrote was called Where the Waters Mingle.
Yeah, I noticed that.
Yeah.
Now there is, of course, one of the explanations is that the Mothman was an Indian curse, one of people's favorites go-tos, I think, you know, mm-hmm. Native American burial grounds, curses, things like this. And, but you talk about a play where this initial idea came from.
Yeah, that story has always seemed absurd to me, the curse. And I bumped into, the seventh generation granddaughter of Chief Cornstalk while I was down there with Zach shooting some nighttime footage, and we ended up getting her into the movie. And she was the first person to tell me about the fact that there's this play and that's where it originated from. But my, you know, obviously what I was thinking at that time was, well, she might just be talking about a play that doesn't even exist. But then we got into the tourism center and Denny told us that no, it doesn't exist. And we have it here on display. So we actually found the play, and were able to take some photos of the actual dialogue where, you know, where the play or where the curse kind of originated. Because the fact is, if you get shot with a musket in the 1700s or whenever 1800s, as you're dying, the odds of you being able to kind of utter this epic paragraphs and paragraphs of dialogue, curse, as you're dying or whatever, it's next to none. The odds that would happen are next to none. So
right.
You know, and I mean, it is a really detailed curse. It's like, you know, that may anyone who stroll upon these grounds, you know, it's so over the top. But yeah, we actually did manage to find the play where that all originated. And a lot of people, I don't know if you know this, but like some people believe that the Mothman itself is like some sort of spiritual sort of being that might be like Chief Cornstalk in flying Thunderbird type form or something like that.
Yeah. So
that's another part of that story. You know, as far as, because everyone connects the curse to all the bad stuff that's happened around town, as far as the floods and all that. But there's also this element that seemed to think that the Mothman itself might be Chief Cornstalk.
I have heard that just vaguely here and there.
Yeah.
And I think Andy Colvin had said something where he believed that it was reincarnating Tibetan monks or something.
Mm-hmm. That sounds about right for Andy.
Yeah, I was a little lost on that one, where he made that connection. But I mean, there's so many different explanations there. And most of them just seem like they're what people kind of put together,
you know, right.
Like it's not based on facts or any kind of evidence. It's just sort of like the folktale sort of explanation.
Well, that's the perfect, kind of example of paranormal research, I think, in general. It's like a microcosm for the whole thing. I mean, in a way that the Mothman case is a microcosm for paranormal research just in general. And it's, we didn't get into that stuff in our movie. And part of the reason is it's been done. There's been a dozen films, like I said, that have focused on the Mothman story where they spend a lot of time like, you know, well, what was the Mothman? And these are the opinions and the ideas. And I figured let's just let people talk or tell the story and then people can kind of sort it out for themselves. We mentioned offhandedly kind of the idea that it might have been some sort of mutated bird. Obviously the prevailing theory amongst skeptics is that it's just a misidentified owl. But you know, I just don't think you can explain away the vast majority of the sightings, or maybe not the vast majority, but you can't explain away all the sightings as simply being a misidentified barred owl.
Right, right. Especially in an area where people are going to know what barn owls are like.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, once the hysteria of it kind of kicks in.
Yeah.
All right. Well, then maybe people are seeing it as a Mothman. You know, they're seeing an owl and they're thinking Mothman because it's on their mind. But the initial sightings, you would think these people are well acquainted enough with the wildlife that surrounds them that they're not going to come to the conclusion of monster over owl.
Right. And it is intriguing that those Birdman sightings were taking place down there in the early 1900s. And I mean, there does seem to be a history in that area of seeing some sort of man-like, bird-like creature, you know, but that kind of opens you up to like, well, maybe this is just I just totally kicked my desk. That kind of opens it up to like, well, maybe it's just an unidentified bird and it's a cryptid or whatever. But then you start, you know, a lot of these sightings where people saw the creature fly, it took off up into the sky without flapping wings. It just flies straight up, you know, and that kind of, to me, there's no natural bird that can just sail off into the sky. It's just one of the weirdest. I've told people this before. When I came into this, I came into the Mothman story pretty skeptically. Not you know, that sounds terrible, but not like a total skeptic or anything like that. But I came into it thinking more than likely this was some sort of a misidentification of some sort of known animal followed by a mild sort of mass hysteria or something like that. But the more people we talk to and the more stuff we find out about it, I just don't know what to think anymore because there's so many different facets to the story, which is part of why I love it and part of why I wish people keep asking if we're making another one. And I have no intention of making a second Mothman of Point Pleasant, but I could see myself if we weren't doing Small Town Monsters the way we are, I could have seen myself making multiple stories about, you know, movies about that story. Hmm. But I think we did manage to get everything that I would have wanted to get into the film, into the film.
Yeah. And it's not like we're going to likely get any new data.
Right.
But one of the things you do address in there is that there have been sightings of strange lights and stuff that go way back past, you know, when the Mothman stuff started.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like I said, I think that's all part of that Ohio Valley.
Yeah.
Thing. And then the Birdman sightings, that was one of the coolest aspects of my research that I turned up. And all the credit on that has to go to Mark Hall, who harkened back to that research that James Gay Jones had done, which was into these folk tales that existed in and around specifically Point Pleasant. It would be one thing if you were talking about a greater West Virginia folk tale. You know, this is like in the state of West Virginia, people see this Birdman. You'd be like, okay, well, that's cool. Maybe it ties to Point Pleasant, but this was like specific to Point Pleasant. People saw this bird-like man preceding a disaster of some kind, or a tragedy, I think is the way that he wrote that. And you know, that book was written well before, or these stories were cataloged anyway, well before the 66, 67 Mothman stuff. So, you know, it just kind of lends to the fact that there might be more going on here than people realize. Especially when it does seem so tied into something that would happen, you know, decades later, because those sightings started around 1911 and they tapered off in the 1940s. And then in a way, if you want to connect them directly, they start up again in the 1960s.
Now, was there a disaster at the end of those sightings?
I don't know if there would have been at the end of those sightings, but there were obviously, if it started in the early 1900s, that's right around the time those massive floods happened. Because there's three or four really bad floods. Now, that area flooded pretty frequently, and that's why they built the flood wall, you know, that surrounds Point Pleasant. But there were three disastrous floods, deadly floods that occurred during the early 1900s. I don't have the exact dates in front of me, but I know there were two in the 30s.
And you know, when you look at some of this stuff like that, I mean, flooding seems like it should be expected to some degree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially because it's built right on the edge of the Ohio River, which back then, today, it's they actually have a fairly easy time of monitoring and you know, controlling the flood, any kind of flooding that would happen because of all the levees and stuff like that. But back then there wasn't anything like that. So I would think the Ohio River just flooded its banks constantly. It's kind of crazy to me that people build these towns right on the banks of a major river like that in their, you know, back then, especially.
But it was also transport back then. So
exactly. Yeah.
You have the quandary of, okay, the river's probably going to overflow, but it's easier to get our stuff in and out.
Right.
You also mentioned the Flatwoods Monster. I didn't realize it was actually close to where that happened.
It's 2 hours away from Point Pleasant. I think it's 2 to 3 hours. I have a friend who actually grew up there in the town where the Braxton County Monster was born. So I know from her that it was, you know, 2 to 3 hours from Point Pleasant. And really, the reason that's in there, the reason the Flatwoods Monster is in the movie is because Flatwoods is one of my favorite stories, and I don't think we'll ever be able to make a movie about it because, you know, there aren't too many, if any, living witnesses left from that story. And I couldn't see myself making a West Virginia monster movie without mentioning Flatwoods in some capacity. And also, it just kind of lends to the fact that area, that, you know, West Virginia, Ohio, Pennsylvania, there's something very ominous about Appalachia.
Fair enough. Yeah, Flatwoods is definitely a weird one, but the Flatwoods also makes me think that, you know, it's one of those cases that could have been a government experiment.
Yes, yeah, that's always been my personal theory.
I mean, Nick Redfern did a good job on tearing that one apart, I think. Mm-hmm. Let's see. What was the other thing I was going to ask you about that? Oh, the first. Okay, so the first modern cases of Mothman happened about when? Like, what was the first reported one?
Yeah, technically the first reported one is that the National Guard Armory sighting that took place right outside of Point Pleasant, right within the area of the TNT factory area, and that one is. And I want to say 1961, but I think it's 66. I just think it's a few days prior to the Scarberry Mallet sighting and the Clendenin sighting. And that was just, there was a National Guard, a National Guardsman who was off duty standing outside of the armory. And he looked across the road and noticed this large, red-eyed creature, man-like bird, I guess, in this tree, and he went back inside and mentioned it offhandedly to someone else, and the story kind of spread around the base. And I'd heard that story prior to making this movie, but I did not know if there was any basis to it, or if it was just another one of these, you know, someone adding their own kind of Mothman story to the legend.
Yeah.
And but it turns out Jeff Walmsley's dad was stationed at he was in the military and was stationed at the National Guard Armory at that time, and remembers those stories going around the base prior to the Scarberry Mallet stuff. So that would have been, again, I don't have my timeline or anything in front of me. I want to say it was just a few days prior to all of that, but that happens. And then the Clendenin sighting is kind of considered the first official sighting of the Mothman. But Clendenin is an hour from Point Pleasant. So that sighting happens. There were four grave diggers digging a grave, and they were watched by this man-like bird for, I think, over 2 hours. And then the next day would have been the Merle Partridge encounter with glowing red lights in his field, which were not eyes, by the way.
Yeah.
Frequently people try to connect the Merle Partridge story to a sighting of the Mothman, but they're not. He clearly said they were, you know, these weird, almost orbs is kind of what he described in this field. And then the day after that would be the official Scarberry Mallet sighting of the Mothman in November of 1966. And from there it hits the newspapers, and that story kind of blows up.
And once it hits the newspapers, it's hard to kind of pull out the noise, in a sense, because now you got to wonder how many people are reporting it, because, you know, either they're convinced they saw it, or because they just want to be a part of it, or whatever.
Right. And it's that way with every one of these stories, because they kind of become you have so many people wanting to insert themselves into the furor kind of surrounding that story.
Yeah.
And a lot of the stories aren't even people actually consciously attempting to insert themselves into it. It's like the media at the time was trying to do that, because the famous one is the Paul Yoder, Benjamin Enoch sighting of the Mothman out near the TNT factory area. But they clearly said they saw a large owl. But the paper took that and said they saw the Mothman. It became a kind of connected to the Mothman story, even though anytime you read a quote from them, they were clearly saying they had seen a large owl.
Right. And the other thing is, how many of the witnesses were still alive when you went to do this?
There are not many of the original witnesses in town. If you go to Point Pleasant, the only one who claims to be an original witness, is Faye DeWitt, but there are others. I spoke with Kathy Walmsley. Kathy was there the night that Marcella Bennett had her sighting out at the TNT factory area. Marcella is obviously it's one of the more famous stories connected with the Mothman. She was visiting friends in the TNT area with the Walmsleys. No relation to Jeff Walmsley, weirdly enough. But they were visiting friends that lived in the TNT area, the Thomas family actually. And some of those kids are still alive because they were visiting a family that had children, and some of the children are still alive and still living in Point Pleasant. So the idea that there are no original witnesses still alive isn't really true at all. There actually are quite a few people still around Point Pleasant who had encounters, whether it was with the Mothman or UFOs or whatever. It's just that most of these people do not go on record and talk about it. I spoke with Kathy about it on the phone, and she obviously, you know, I had her relay her version of events from the night of Marcella's encounter, but she refused to go on camera to tell me her encounter story. So I actually think, and from talking with other people around town, I was told by the editor of the local paper that there are more people there that claim encounters than you would believe. And she said there's reputable people who claim encounters from 66 and 67 too, UFO sightings and Mothman alike, that have never told us anyone, you know, outside of their close circle of friends about their sightings.
And that's understandable. I think that happens a lot, you know. That's why it's hard to register how many sightings are legit.
Right. And when you get the most difficult thing about it is Keel at one point said that there were upwards of 200 sightings of the Mothman. But, you know, in the record, the stories that we know of, I don't really count more than 35 or 40 in terms of 66 and 67. That have been documented by any number of authors. So it's difficult to say. And the frustrating thing is, like, Keel's archive does not include many original witness reports and things like that, his original documentation on those reports. And I'm curious to know if that is because of the fact that you might remember this in the Mothman Prophecies. I think it makes mention of the fact that his car was broken into. Yeah, and a bunch of his research was stolen from the car. And I've always wondered if it wasn't, if that part of it, if his original Mothman files weren't a large part of what was taken. Because when I've spoken to his archivist, and he said there just are not many files relating directly to the Mothman.
Yeah, and hasn't that also fueled some speculation that he was inventing some of it?
I'm sure it has. I've never pegged Keel as that kind of researcher, and I know from speaking with friends of his that isn't really the vibe that people got off of Keel. It was, if anything, what I was told most recently by someone that knew him is he never would have invented things, but he was definitely extremely paranoid and possibly had over exaggerated some of the Men in Black type stuff that happened.
Okay. Well, I mean, that makes sense, I guess. If you're paranoid, that's definitely going to fuel it.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what that stuff seems to do, is fuel paranoia. Yeah. Let's talk a little more about some of the, how all this came to be. We mentioned briefly the TNT area. Now, what is that now?
Today it is the McClintock Wildlife Management Area, which is a, I can tell you about it. It's weird. I had been to the TNT area while we were making the movie, obviously, and the area is overgrown and it's basically a hunting. People go there and hunt now. But there's these massive waterways and ponds, and then there's these abandoned TNT bunkers that they used to store TNT inside of, and there are these concrete kind of bunkers burrowed into the side of these mounds that you'll find popping up all over the area. There's dirt roads that snake all over the place, and the undergrowth is so thick in most parts that you can't even walk into the woods if you want to during the middle of summer. Now, we were there in winter, and even then, it would have been difficult because of the thorns and stuff like that. But when I was there a few weeks ago, we were, like I said, we were making this TV show, and I actually got to kind of experience some parts of the TNT area that I hadn't been to before. So I got to go back to where the aqueducts are, and into some of the abandoned buildings, including this abandoned silo that's super creepy that I got to go inside of, and. It was it was extremely a really cool experience, but also really frustrating because I was frustrated that we didn't know about most of these places while we were filming our movie, because I would have loved to have shot inside of some of these abandoned buildings that we went inside of. But, you know, it's one of those things where when you're there, I don't know. We've done so many stories about like Bigfoot and stuff, and there's something kind of unnerving about the fact that you're never fully sure that there isn't some sort of undiscovered creature nearby ready to rip your head off. But when you're doing like a Mothman movie, there, you know, the sightings haven't been as frequent as with a Bigfoot.
Right.
And so there's a disconnect that happens where it's more like you're on a, some sort of like historical scouting trip or something instead of monster hunting. Cause there's, in my mind anyway, there's no way I'm going to bump into the Mothman out there. It'd be awesome if I did, but I just, you know, when you're in that place, but at the same time, you can definitely see why those sightings happened there, because it's so isolated and overgrown and creepy and definitely a magnet for weird activity. Cause we did have some creepy stuff happen to us out there.
Really? Like what?
Like just something throwing rocks at us from the woods. In a place where there really shouldn't be any people. It's pretty far from where we were, was in a private section of the management area, at least a part that's almost impossible, you know, to get into without it, I guess, knowing exactly where to go. And then some weird mumbled kind of speech that we heard. I'm keeping this super vague because the story is so ridiculous and full of weird details that to tell it in like a quick kind of quick and dirty way is next to impossible. we had rocks thrown at us, and then we heard this bizarre kind of mumbled speech.
Could you make any of it out?
No, it was classic kind of Bigfoot type stuff, actually.
I always like referring to that now as wilderness poltergeists.
Yeah. Well, it's funny you'd say that, because that's what one of the Frick brothers, when we were down there for the early screening of the movie, mentioned that to us. They were like, well, that could be like poltergeist activity.
Well, because that's what it resembles. The only difference is it's in the woods rather than in a house.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, short of seeing an actual creature, you know.
Yeah.
But it is interesting that you had those experiences in that area.
And when we had them. Because that's, again, like, it's very difficult to explain the story, what was going on and all the details of the story. But it was in the middle of trying to film a TV show, and there was a crew with us, and we had this weird stuff start happening.
Is any of it on film?
Yeah, actually, it probably is. I don't have the, you know, obviously it's on film for the Japanese film crew that was shooting it, but I don't have any of that footage. I should ask them about that, though. I hadn't even thought of that.
So that's not something that's going to be released here?
No, it will be released on the Tokyo broadcast system for their audience.
Yeah, well, that's too bad.
We might get a copy. I'm trying to get at least a copy for ourselves, you know, so we can check it out.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's look at the eyes. Actually, one of the things I wanted to mention, you added into this one that I don't think you had on the other ones, and correct me if I'm wrong, but you have some computer animation on this one.
Yeah, we have a little bit of computer animation and then the animated sequences that Chris Scalf did. The CG we had done was done in a matter of like 5 days by someone with a full-time job. So he managed to crank out, you know, like I think for what it is and for the amount of time it's in the film, I think he did an amazing job. His name's Nathaniel McRoby, and I actually met him because I do that Minerva Monster Day festival here in Ohio.
Right.
And part of that is that we did a film festival and one of his movies was submitted to it. And I remember when I saw the movie, I thought if I ever need CGI in one of our movies, I got to contact this guy. Cause I could tell he kind of like, he's self-taught himself and he's trying to get better at it. And he just seemed like he would fit in with us. Cause we're a bunch of guys who don't know what we're doing. So we all kind of, when I contacted him, he was pretty pumped up about it. So yeah, there's quick shots of the Mothman here and there. There's some eyes here and there, and then we have the fully animated sequences by Chris that I think are incredible. So
yeah, no, it definitely adds a lot to it.
Yeah, no, and from now on, that's how our movies are going. I can't see ourselves going back to like the Minerva style of completely scaling back on any kind of recreation stuff. Now, I don't like dramatized recreations. I never will. I don't think I'll ever shoot like entire recreated sequences where actors are speaking to each other and stuff like that. I just can't. In documentaries, that takes me right out of it. But we call what we're doing ambiguous B-roll. So we like shooting that kind of stuff. And there's definitely more of that coming up in Invasion and moving forward. That's more of our style. It's kind of like it's a combination of what we'd been doing all along and then adding in something to give people a little bit of a jolt too.
Now you did have some older interviews in here from some of the people that passed away.
Mm-hmm.
And where did those come from?
The Marcella Bennett interview that we projected onto the interior of the igloo, that was shot by a guy named Jonathan Heat. And he had shot it and used it in a mini documentary he made that was on TV, I think in like Toledo or Cincinnati, I can't remember. And I just found that purely by accident on YouTube. And I contacted him and I was like, hey, I'd love to have access to this interview. I was like, if you'd let me use it, you know, he'd give you credit and all that stuff. So he was very excited about that. So that's Jonathan's interview that he had shot with Marcella back in the early 2000s. What's funny about that is he's also got interviews with like Jeff Walmsley and a couple other locals on there. And if you can find the documentary on YouTube, it's kind of fun to watch because it's so old and it's before the Mothman was popular. You know, I think it might have even been before the Mothman Prophecies movie came out.
Really?
Yeah. And Jeff's like working in his record store and, you know, it's very old school. But that was Jonathan's. And then the three audio interviews we have in there were all recorded by Jeff Walmsley and given to us to use in the film with Merle Partridge or Noel Partridge, Bob Bosworth and Tom Urey. So, and there's a couple more audio taped interviews we didn't use in the movie that we could have, but for a time we didn't. But there was, our big concern going into this is that we wouldn't have any original witnesses. And I think we ended up with quite a few, if you count those archival kind of things into the mix, because we have Lawrence Gray and we've got Faye DeWitt and then the four archivals. So there's six original witnesses directly in the film, which is pretty cool because I don't, especially when you're talking about as far removed as we are from that case, a lot of those people have died. So it's have a voice for them again.
Including Keel, who, you know, did so much research on it. And Gray Barker's dead, right? Gray Barker's dead.
Mm-hmm.
Because Gray Barker died a while ago, didn't he?
Yeah, they just celebrated, or not celebrated, but someone just did some sort of retrospective because I think his passing was the anniversary of his passing or whatever was fairly recently.
And they were really the two that wrote the majority of stuff on this.
Yeah, I mean, Heyer was documenting it, I think, as religiously as Keel was, if not more so. I just don't think, you know, because it was in the papers and stuff, we don't have...
Yeah.
That what I would love to see is I'd love to see someone go and track down all of her articles and compile them in some sort of book or something like that. Cause I'm sure there's a ton there that we don't know about that she had written.
What do you make of the red eye thing?
The red eye thing. I don't know. You know, like that's one of the things that makes me pretty sure this wasn't just some sort of, known animal or, you know, unknown animal even. I mean, it's one of those things that always makes me scratch my head about the Bigfoot stuff too, because it's frequently cited in Bigfoot reports, the red eyes.
Yeah.
I'll tell you that there's and I'm not debunking the red eyes or debunking the existence of Mothman here. I'm just pointing this out. There's a smokestack right near where the Scarberries and the Mallets had their sighting. Mm-hmm. And you can just see it over the trees from the exact location where their sighting took place. And there's these two huge red lights on there. And on a certain kind of night, we were there on a windy night, and the wind blows the smoke kind of around behind them. And I took a couple of pictures of it. I should post them at some point. It looks like a creature with red eyes and huge wings.
Really?
Yeah, like billowing wings. And again, I'm not debunking it. I'm just pointing. It's a weird kind of coincidence or whatever that is in that exact spot. Now, that doesn't do anything to explain away how moments after they saw the creature in that spot, they would have been chased by a smokestack. You know,
right.
But I just we took a couple of pictures of it when we were there, because I've wondered over the time since we filmed how many subsequent sightings that took place in that area were people seeing those smokestacks.
Yeah, well, that's entirely possible.
Yeah,
I mean, especially if they look that. I mean, the coincidence of them looking that way is kind of odd when you think about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the other thing is people have often tried to shoot down the Scarberry Mallet sighting as like they were on drugs that night. Mm-hmm. Because people, they were smoking pot or whatever. But pot doesn't really make you hallucinate. And especially, I don't know. I know it can cause some paranoid side effects, but you know, as far as hallucinating a glowing red-eyed monster, I just don't know that necessarily falls within the parameters of marijuana usage.
Yeah, that's not a generally normal side effect.
Yeah.
But of course, when you look at the time period, it was kind of pushed as one of those things marijuana could do to you.
Sure.
You know, I mean, we know better now, but back then that doesn't seem like an unreasonable explanation.
Well, I'll tell you that there are people that live in Point Pleasant who are alive at that time who believe that that is what they saw, that they were on drugs and that they just had some sort of hallucination. That's kind of the go-to argument for the existence of Mothman among some of the older people from the area. That's what I heard most frequently. In fact, there was a guy, there's someone that's in the movie who told me that the night that they came into the police station to report their sighting, that everyone in the police station was convinced they were on drugs.
Well, wouldn't that go along with the fact that they're panicking and reporting a monster? You know?
Yeah.
That's a hard one right there.
Well, and I think probably the amount of times I've heard that as an argument for a sighting of almost anything, it's especially amongst the older generation, that seems to be, you know, what drugs are you on? Kind of
thing. Fair enough. You talk about the one explanation that was offered up, that it was a crane. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I've heard that before, but the way you presented it, it almost made more sense that that would be suggested, because the way you presented in the documentary is that they basically called somebody and said, what could generate these sightings? And he went, well, maybe a giant crane. Whereas I always had the impression this was some debunker coming in being like, no, 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 it's just a crane.
Well, I think there is that element to it as well. But there was a professor from West Virginia University who was... So the point that he made was that the sighting started in November, and the sandhill crane is not native to West Virginia. It's not native to Point Pleasant, but they do migrate through the area starting in November. Mm-hmm. So the sighting started in November, and it's right around the same time that the sandhill crane migrates through the area. I wonder if the sandhill crane wasn't responsible for like the, you know, the Gallipolis airport sighting where the pilot saw the large creature with a bill and a 4-foot neck fly overhead. Now, again, though, I mean, pilots misidentifying a bird for that they said that the bird they saw was the size of a plane.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I realize it's difficult at a distance to judge the size of something, especially when it's in the air, but I can't really see pilots making that mistake. I could have seen them messing with people and pranking that, but I don't know. The crane idea to me actually makes less sense than an owl. Because even though it has those red kind of reddish, you know, circles around the eyes, it's not at all physically what people describe seeing. You know, I could almost see an owl over a sandhill crane because of the fact that the sandhill crane has those long spindly legs. It's got these really weird, you know, tapered wings, and then it's got this huge bill. And so I don't know. I think the sandhill crane idea makes less sense than a lot of the other typical debunking arguments.
And neither of them take off like a helicopter.
Right.
Now, right. It wasn't so much that it was spinning like a helicopter, just that it went straight up like a helicopter.
Just straight up like a helicopter. And I know it pissed some of the original witnesses off that helicopter thing was quoted so often. And the reason I know that is because on the original audio taped interview with Tom Urey that Jeff gave me, he was pretty irate that Keel had quoted him as saying it moved like a helicopter, or it looked like a helicopter. Because he said that wasn't at all what he meant. What he meant was merely that it looked like the way it took off straight up was like a helicopter. Because apparently that was something else that was going on at the time, was that people were frequently quoting witnesses as saying that it looked like a helicopter, which is hilarious if you really think about it. But I think more than anything, they were just referring to the way it flew.
Yeah, not like a bird would, flapping its wings and then slowly gaining height. It just kind of zips straight up.
We're straight up in the air, yeah.
Which is more of a UFO thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, and I mean, the UFOs going on at the same time are something that I had typically, I didn't know what to make of it. So for the most part, I kind of ignored that part of the story. Not ignored it, but I just didn't know what to make of it. So I kind of discontinued it. But when I really started researching the movie, I don't know that you can separate any of these phenomena one from the other.
No,
so that's why the Men in Black are in the movie. That's why the UFOs are in the movie. And then we do have the sighting from, I want to say it's May of 1967, when the school teachers saw what they said looked like a flying man in the sky actually go into a UFO. We mentioned that toward the back half of the movie, during the section of the movie we call a pattern of escalation.
and it is definitely just a plethora of Fortiana in this place. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's no way around it. There's so many different things that occurred around the same time period. Whereas you do see it sometimes, I think this is like the penultimate example of this type of thing.
Yeah.
That's why it fascinated me so much. Were you able to talk to anyone who had Men in Black encounters?
There's only one lady I know of in town who claims to have had a Men in Black encounter. We did not get to speak with her. Now, Faye DeWitt claims to have had a Men in Black encounter, but we didn't speak about that side of her story because it came along much later, and I felt that was a little odd. But Faye tells the story that her and her brother went back to the scene of their sighting, I think the next day or a day later, and the area was roped off, and there were these men in black suits there who told them they were not allowed in the area. You know, they couldn't be there. It was private property and everything, and ran them off. Now, Faye, for whatever reason, Faye kind of believes that the Men in Black had actually captured the Mothman and took it away. And I forget why she says that. She might have some story about a strange truck leaving the area, I think is what her story is. I just heard her tell it recently. She's the only one that I've actually spoken to who claims to have had a direct encounter with the Men in Black. Have you seen the photo taken from Point Pleasant in 67 of what they think might have been one of the actual Men in Black?
Standing on the street corner?
Yeah.
It's kind of cool, but at the same time, not overly convincing.
Right.
Because, I mean, it's not completely different from the way people dressed anyway.
Exactly, yeah. The only thing about that photo, and I don't know if I'm just reading into it when I look at it, but there's something off about that dude's face. Like, he almost looks like a mannequin to me.
No, that would fit with the descriptions of them not looking quite right.
Yeah.
What else did I want to get to here real quick? Oh, it, aside from like the conjunctivitis that people, that someone came down with from seeing one of these UFOs, which, you know, you don't normally get from birds. Mm-hmm. Did it actually harm anyone other than just scaring them?
No, I don't know of anything where someone claimed to be wounded by it or injured, you know, in any way. There's a lot of emotional ramifications from an encounter, obviously, like yeah. what happened with Linda over the years, claiming she wished she'd never seen it and all that stuff. But no, I can't. And we get asked that a lot. And there might be, like, I'm if you're talking 200 sightings, I'm sure at some point, whether they were telling the truth or not, someone had to have claimed to have had some sort of encounter where they were like picked up and then dropped, you know, or something like that. There has to be a story like that, but nothing that I've come across.
Because it seems like its big thing was just that it frightened people.
Yeah, it loved scaring people.
And if that's the worst thing it did, well, maybe it's not that bad.
Yeah.
Now, of course, the belief is this all culminated in the collapse of the Silver Bridge. And, you know, I mean, you can see how that buildup happens and, you know, then the bridge collapses and the sightings decline. But is there necessarily a connection?
No. I mean, well, again, that's my personal opinion that no, there's no connection. I think the Silver Bridge collapse acted as a closing of the door on the story for a lot of people, for the bulk of people. It doesn't mean that sightings stopped, and we point that out in the narration, the fact that sightings did continue and still continue today, but they're just far more infrequent than they used to be, especially during 66 and 67 when everything was happening. But in my personal opinion, the Silver Bridge collapse just kind of acted as a bookend to the story. Sightings continued that night, the night that the bridge collapsed, there were swarms of UFOs seen up and down the Ohio River. So I don't think that any of this 100% just stopped at that point, but people definitely quit talking about it. And we kind of, you know, in most of these movies about the Silver Bridge collapse, they do try to connect the two. And we just kind of, instead of focusing on that, our focus was simply on the bridge collapsed, and then we let the people that lived there kind of tell their part of that story. If anyone that we had spoken to had a story about, you know, well, I saw the Mothman over the bridge, or people were seeing the Mothman over the bridge, I would have put it in the film. But for the most part, everyone we spoke to said that at the time, no one was connecting the two, and that didn't start until much later. In fact, I think it's not in the film, but George Dudding told us that the homeless people that lived under the bridge were the first people to start saying that the Mothman had been seen around the collapse, around the site of the bridge collapse.
Huh. Well, Keel kind of suggested in the Mothman prophecies as well.
Did he? Okay.
You know, that there was some kind of connection, like this thing was a harbinger, you know.
Definitely, yeah. No, and I mean, and that, I think, is what they mean by it didn't really come up until later. I think Keel's the kind of guy who suggested that for the first time, and then it's ballooned into the kind of our conscious when we're talking about this case. It's like the Mothman has become... Well, I think the way Denny said it is the Silver Bridge collapse has become just a part of the Mothman legend to most younger people, which is a shame, because it's a very real tragedy, and it more than likely had nothing to do with it.
Right. And because the thing about the Silver Bridge collapse is that it's not like it was something paranormal.
Yeah.
It's not like, oh my God, we can't explain why this bridge collapsed. No, we know why the bridge collapsed. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't that weird of a thing. It was that it had never been taken care of like it should have.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my favorite story connecting the bridge collapse to anything weird or paranormal, and I use the word favorite loosely, obviously, because anything that involves the death of so many people it's hard to find an upside to that. But there's the story about the plainclothes men that were seen around the bridge like the day before the collapse. And I've always thought that was very fascinating because of all the sightings of the Men in Black going on and at that time. And then people started seeing these strange guys, you know, dressed in plain clothes around the bridge, climbing on the bridge the day before it collapsed. I've always thought that was kind of a curious side story.
And it seems like with the release of the movie back in the early 2000s, that there was a lot of mythology kind of added in as part of the viral marketing.
Yep.
And that didn't help matters.
No, I mean, it never does. and it's a shame. This is the reason a lot of people that live in Point Pleasant will never embrace the mythology or embrace the local legend or the monster. It's because of the fact that they feel like it overrode the very real tragedy that took, you know, family and loved ones from people. Yeah. I mean, but, you know, at the same time, Carolyn Harris lost a 4-year-old son on the bridge, and she helped to organize the festival. So,
well, sure, because it brings in revenue to the people of the town.
Yeah, exactly.
And not that that's a bad thing. I mean, it's just, it makes sense that you would do something like that if people were interested in coming out, like the Roswell Festival and such.
Yeah.
The other thing about, there was something else about the bridge collapse I was going to mention, other than the muddying of the waters there. Huh. I don't remember what it was. All right. Well, what's one of your most striking of all the encounters you heard about this, which one strikes you the strongest?
It's Lawrence Gray's. It's the easiest to explain away, but it's also the way it's affected him and the way he told the story. Lawrence woke up one night and claims to have seen the Mothman standing at the foot of his bed. And his story encompasses maybe 2 minutes, or maybe if not less time than that. I mean, he woke up, he sees this figure standing at the foot of his bed. He starts reciting the name of Jesus, and the thing disappeared like putting salt on a slug, is how he said it. Yeah. But you know, when we interviewed him, it's hard, maybe it doesn't, I don't know how well it comes across on camera, but his hands were shaking. I thought he was going to cry a couple times during the interview. It stuck with him, and he says in the interview that it stuck with him. It's been, you know, years since it happened, and he thinks about it every day. So, you know, and it's the easiest one to say, well, he had a night terror or something.
Yeah,
like that.
Yeah, sleep paralysis, right. Something like that. Yeah.
Right. But the way it affected him is, I think, what stood out the most about that to me. And I think that interview actually is one of the most intense I've ever been a part of, period.
Hmm. Yeah, it definitely came across as a pretty intense interview. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay. Let's see. Was there anything else I wanted to get to before I let you go? I think that was the majority of it. People should, of course, go watch it. Where can people find it?
We're streaming on Amazon. So if you go to Amazon and just search for The Mothman of Point Pleasant, or you watch it on Vimeo On Demand, which is vimeo.com/on-demand/The Mothman. And then shop.smalltownmonsters.com has the DVD and soundtrack and mini posters and t-shirts and all kinds of stuff.
Okay. The other thing I was going to mention about the bridge collapse is that it also makes sense that, like if this phenomena somehow draws power from attention, and once that bridge collapsed, no one cared about these paranormal monsters anymore, and they were focused on the bridge, it would make sense that the sightings would then kind of
disappear. Yeah. Yeah. But see, I just don't think they disappeared, because they were still happening, and you can still find stories about people seeing it. Maybe the Mothman sightings did taper off at that point, but I think UFOs, I don't think the UFOs went anywhere. Like there really are quite a few UFO stories from even that day that the Silver Bridge collapsed. There was a family, and I think this is a story from the Mothman prophecies, but Keel talks about a family that lived on the Ohio River that actually moved out of their home because of the amount of UFO activity that started taking place around their home. And that was right around the time of the Silver Bridge collapse.
Hmm, I do remember that.
Yeah.
All right. What's your website?
Smalltownmonsters.com.
Okay. And people can find all of your links to everything from there?
Everything is there. We are hard at work on our fifth film, Invasion on Chestnut Ridge. I've been working on a trailer today, and that is coming October 20th as well. So all that info is on our website, and then our Facebook page gets updated pretty frequently as well.
All right. Awesome. Well, I look forward to the next one.
Cool.
All right. As I said, if you're a Patreon, I'm going to be giving away 5 copies of the streaming version of Mothman of Point Pleasant to you later in the week. So I'll figure out how I'm going to do that later in the week as well. You can become a Patreon at wheredidtheroadgo.com. And also, if you're a band or a musician and you'd like us to consider using your stuff for an outro, it doesn't matter what style it is, get in touch at contact@wheredidtheroadgo.com. This week's outro music is from a band called Daga Punishment. That's D-A-G-G-A Punishment. And you can find them at soundcloud.com/Daga-Punishment. We're going to hear a track entitled A Tradition's, like magician, but with a T, A Tradition's Tools. See you next time.
We'll be right back.